very clear before we begin this year. We live in a generation, as we all know, I need not tell anyone here, where information is so readily available, so easily accessible to anyone who wants it. And we oftentimes feel almost overloaded with information. You can Google anything, you can find out anything about any particular area of life that you might be interested in. And one of the results of this new phenomenon that we're living through is that people can easily consider themselves worthy of offering opinions on very important communal matters, on extremely critical communal issues, and at times they insert themselves into communal matters that are way out of their league. I was talking to a doctor this week in our shul who said to me that what he fears most in his patients who come to see him is the phenomenon of Dr. Google. And he said that it really bothers him. You know, it's good as a patient to be well-informed, it's good to do your research, but he said he finds that people come to his office, they do a quick Google search about whatever it is that they might be suffering with, whatever it is that they need help with, and they find some sources and they find certain articles, and then they insert their opinions on very serious medical issues, very serious medical problems, and at times they can have very critical consequences. And that's what he said as a doctor he finds is a very dangerous phenomenon, and it's something that he's challenged with. I think in the world of the rabbinate, in the world of the leadership of our Jewish community, I think it's a problem as well. It's something that very often someone will get a shaila and the person on the other line will say, but I Googled it and it says this. So it's wonderful to be well informed. I think it's the job of the rabbi or whoever is passing the shaila to explain to the people why it is that they arrive at the psak that they came to. But at the same time, a common refrain that we hear quite often in our generation, at least in my generation, is someone will say, show me the source. And if you can't point chapter and verse in Shulchan Aruch to where it says that, it's as if it doesn't exist at all. So this is something that is a great challenge. It's something that is very difficult. And what's often lacking, I find, in these very important conversations that we have, either individually or as a community, is a recognition and a deep appreciation for what our Mesorah, for what our tradition, for what our Minhagim actually mean, and how they play a very critical role in the landscape of Jewish community affairs in general. So over the last few weeks, I'm sure many of us are aware, there has been a lot of rich discussion about some very critical communal issues that are happening all across America and the American Jewish scene. And these conversations and articles that I have both read and been a part of have given me personally the opportunity to think a great deal about our communal appreciation and our communal understanding of what the role of Mesorah, what the role of tradition, what the role of Minhagim, what the role of our custom, of our heritage, of our rituals actually is in the life of an observant Jew. It's given me the opportunity to think about things that very often I don't think about, and I'm sure many of us don't think about also. What I'd like to talk about today is the place for Minhag and Mesorah and how central of a component it is in the life of the practicing, God-fearing Orthodox Jew. Let me make one thing clear before we begin this year. I do not live a life where I condemn or criticize other people, other schools, other institutions. It's not my place to do that, and it's not of interest to me either. I don't want anyone to feel that anything that we say today is a condemnation of anyone else. All I want to speak about is conceptually. I want to talk in the abstract without getting at all political, without being at all disrespectful to anyone else. People can live their lives the way they want. I'm just trying to explain to our community what exactly it means to uphold a Mesorah, why Mesorah and Minhagim are important to us, why we feel it's something that we cannot ever compromise, and why it's something that we should think about every so often. So I think there's no better way to begin than with the very powerful and beautiful words of Rav Soloveitchik. Okay. Right, so this is certainly not going to be a one-week class. I think there's a lot to talk about when we discuss Mesorah. I think that's a very important issue when, unfortunately, after the Shoah, a lot of people lost their Minhagim and Mesorah, not by any fault of their own, but they just didn't have the opportunity to understand what their family Minhagim should or were before everything struck. So let's just begin. This is, I guess, an introductory shiur to Minhagim and Mesorah. Next week, some of the women last night when I gave the shiur asked that we talk about when a person switches communities, when a person gets married, and sometimes you have some conflicts in Mesorah there and Minhagim. I think these are all very important issues. And really, I think it gets back to the issue that a number of women raised a few weeks ago, and that is if a woman, or for that matter anyone, takes upon themselves some Minhag Tov, So a number of the women were asking, if I take upon myself that I want to daven Maariv, even though a woman might not be obligated to do so, but if she feels she has extra time, she should. So what happens at a point where it becomes too difficult? So do we need to do a Hataras Nedarim? Do we assume that becomes a minhag and now it's something that's binding? Do we assume it's only binding for the time that I'm able and available to do so? So these are all very important issues. Just by way of introduction to all of that, I would like to just focus on the idea of Mesorah in general. So Rav Soloveitchik spoke at a Pidyon HaBen in 1974. And I think if you have the opportunity, this is a speech that he gave in English. It's something that was very off the cuff. It was unprepared remarks. They asked him to speak at a Pidyon HaBen, and this is what he said unprepared. It was so beautiful, and later it was transcribed. If you have the opportunity, go online. I just said you shouldn't Google, but go on Google and find this talk online. You can hear the actual voice, and now they have a subtitle that goes along with it. They made a video of it. It's really beautiful. It's very powerful, and I think it's a good way to begin such a conversation. So look what he says in the very beginning of the source sheet. I start the shiur. He's describing what it feels like every time that he walks into his classroom and he's ready to teach his talmidim, his students. I start the shiur. I don't know what the conclusion will be. Whenever I start the shiur, the door opens. Another old man walks in and sits down, meaning, aside from myself, another old man walks in. He is older than I am. All the talmidim call me the Rav. He is older than the Rav. He is the grandfather of the Rav. His name is Rav Chaim Brisker, and without whom no shiur can be delivered nowadays. Then the door opens quietly again, and another man comes in. He is older than Rav Chaim. He lived in the 17th century. What is his name? Shabsi HaKoin. Who's Shabsi HaKoin? The Shach. The famous Shach who must be present when Dini Mamonos, when civil law are being discussed. And then more visitors show up. Some of the visitors lived in the 11th century. Some in the 12th century. Some in the 13th century. Some lived in antiquity. Rebbe Kiva, Rashi, Rabbi Notam, the Ravid, the Rashba. And more come in and come in and come in. Of course, what do? I introduce them to my pupils and the dialogue commences. Such a beautiful, such a moving description of what happens when you learn Torah. Who ever thinks about it like this? Of course, what do? I introduce them to my pupils and the dialogue commences. The Rambam says something. So the feels when he's quoting the Rambam is actually sitting here voicing his opinion. The Ravid disagrees. Sometimes he's very nasty. A boy jumps up to defend the Rambam against the Ravid. A boy jumps up to defend the Rambam against the Ravid. And the boy is fresh. You know how young boys are. He uses improper language, so I correct him. And another jumps up with a new idea. The Rashba smiles gently. I try to analyze what the young boy meant. Another boy intervenes. Then we call upon Rabbeinu Tam to express his opinion. And suddenly, a symposium of generations comes into existence. Such a beautiful expression. And I didn't have enough room to put the rest of it on. This is just an off-the-cuff speech that he gave at a Pidyon HaBen. But the paragraph continues a little bit more. I didn't put it on here. Just listen to this. So he's talking about the description of all the generations coming together, as he calls it, a symposium of generations that all come together in a classroom to try to learn the Torah Hashem and to try to understand it in the proper way. He then writes, we all speak one language. Vayihi kal haaretz safa achas udvarim achadim. Which, loosely translated, the whole earth was of one language and of one purpose. We all chat. We all laugh. We all enjoy the company. We all pursue one common goal. We are all committed to a common vision and we all operate with the same categories. There is a misora collegiality, a Mesorah friendship, a camaraderie between old and young, between antiquity, middle ages, and modern times. This community of generations, this march of centuries, this conversation of generations, this dialogue between antiquity and present will finally bring the redemption of the contemporary Jew. That's what he felt every time he got up to study the beautiful Torah that he did. This is what it means every time we engage in Talmud Torah on our own. We engage generations, we have conversations with the millennia, we bring and we invite the leading people who understood what the Torah meant and what it represents, what it stands for. All of those personalities join us each and every time we study the Torah that God gave us. And in fact, the Gemara tells us, God Himself is present when we learn Torah as well. He also joins the conversation. As the Pasuk says, Bechal makom asher azkir ashemi, any time where my name, where my Torah is studied, Avo elecha overachticha, I will be there alongside you, and I will say the words along with you as well. It's a very powerful imagery to think about. And when you think about it in that way, it should be humbling a little bit, our approach toward Talmud Torah. It's humbling because it means that we come along with generations, with millennia of personalities who join us in our conquest and our sincerity when we try to approach the Torah with truth and with honesty, when we try to understand everything that it means. Let's continue with what Rav Soloveitchik writes somewhere else. What does Kabbalah Sol Malchus Shamayim require of the Lamed HaTorah? We know we have a concept, we have an idea of being Mekabel Ol Malchus Shamayim, accepting the yoke of heaven on ourselves. What does that mean when a person learns Torah? The person who studies Torah, first, we must pursue the truth and nothing else but the truth. When a person is engaged in Talmud Torah, we leave everything else aside. We engage with the truth and we only look for the truth and the absolute truth. With no preconceived notions, with nothing pushing in any agenda or any direction, we look at the Torah in its absolute and pristine form. However, the truth in Talmud Torah can only be achieved through singular halachic Torah thinking and Torah understanding. I think what that means is that every discipline that we have in our world, every scientific experiment, any discipline that you might think of, that you might be engaged in, has its own axioms, has its own systems, has its own understandings. And here, says Rav Soloveitchik, the Torah works the same way. We have axioms in the way Torah is supposed to be understood, and the way it's supposed to be deciphered, and the way it's supposed to be read, and the way it's supposed to be taught and learned. And those are the axioms that have to guide us through our process of learning Torah anytime we do so. You cannot just make up the rules as you go along, because that's like going and trying to do a scientific experiment when you know it goes against the rules of science. It's just not going to work. You're not going to get the result that is the truthful one. And so too here, says Rav Soloveitchik. Look at the bold and underline. The truth is attained from within, in accord with the methodology given to Moshe and passed on from generation to generation. That is where the truth lies, in the Torah itself, in the Mesorah that we have, in the understandings that were passed down to us from Moshe Rabbeinu, from generation to generation. The truth can be discovered only through joining the ranks of Chachmei HaMesorah. The only way to come about an absolute truth, an understanding of what Torah means and how it's supposed to inform and guide us, is if a person makes sure that they discover it through joining the ranks of Chachmei HaMesorah. Through joining those leagues of people, of personalities, who represented the Mesorah that we stand for. It is ridiculous to say I've discovered something of which the Rashba didn't know, the Tzos didn't know, the Vilna Gaon had no knowledge. I've discovered an approach to the interpretation of Torah which is completely new. It is ridiculous. And one must join the ranks of Chachmei HaMesorah, of Chazal, of the Rishonim, of the Gedolei Achronim, and must not try to rationalize from without the Chukei HaTorah. We have laws in the Torah, we have a Mesorah, we have a tradition of how to interpret all of those laws in the Torah. And in order to properly do so, we need to attach ourselves to what we call the Chachmei HaMesorah, to those generations of personalities who have come before us and tried to give us their very best understanding of what the Torah represents to them and how they interpreted it. We must not judge the Chukim u'Mishpatim in terms of the secular system of values. And it's so hard for us. We live as modern Orthodox Jews. We encourage our children and our families to be engaged in the world and to have all that we can in involvement in all that goes on around us. Where do we draw the line? How do we make sure that those systems do not infiltrate and shift our perspective in the system that the Torah is itself? It's very difficult. I don't think anyone is ill-intentioned nowadays when they make the wrong choices, when they interpret things in the wrong way. They want the best for the Jewish people. I don't doubt that. But they're just not connected to the Chachmei HaMesorah. Because our generation has become so infused, so engaged with everything that surrounds us, it's very hard to split that. It's very hard to divorce ourselves from it when we're trying to come and have a truthful understanding, unadulterated understanding of what the Torah means to inform us of. Such an attempt, he writes, and this is so prophetic. Listen what he says. Such an attempt, be it historicism, be it psychologism. I don't know that those are words. Be it utilitarianism, undermines the very foundations of Torah u'Mesorah, and it leads eventually to the most tragic consequences of assimilation, no matter how good the original intentions are of the person who suggested them. If a person is going to approach the Torah without using the logic and the axioms that the Torah is meant to be studied by, if we don't study the Torah in its purest, most unadulterated state, it can lead, as Rav Soloveitchik said, to the most tragic of consequences. And how sad is it that there are so many who have called into question the value of Mesorah in our generation and whether or not it's of any importance to any of us. Keep looking what Rav Soloveitchik writes further. Second, we're in the last paragraph on the first side of the sheet. Second, we must not yield, I mean emotionally, and I find this such a great challenge for anyone who's on social media. I don't know how many people are or are not, how many people follow. A lot of times there are very rich discussions, a lot of times there are very poor discussions. But I find something that is such a challenge if you follow just social media or if you follow the articles that come out, and I like to read many of them. I find what Rav Soloveitchik describes here to be so difficult. You look at the onslaught of things that have been written. I sometimes feel like I'm a dinosaur. Like, I still believe in the Mesorah. I'm the only one. Or maybe it is that all the people who believe in the Mesorah just don't write. But look where Rav Soloveitchik says. We must not yield, I mean emotionally. It is very important. We must not feel inferior. I often read these things and I feel like, who's left in our community that really still believes, that's really holding on? There is such a tidal wave that's going in the other direction. We must not feel inferior or experience or develop an inferiority complex. And because of that complex, yield to the charm. Usually it is a transient and passing charm. How true is this? Usually it is a transient and a passing charm of modern political and ideological svarot, which means thought or assumptions that we have based on our outside ideologies, based on a political consideration. I say not only not to compromise, says Rav Soloveitchik, certainly not to compromise, but even not to yield emotionally. That also is our job. Don't feel like the dinosaur. Don't feel like that person who's on the outs. You represent the Mesorah. That is what you stand for. That is what you uphold. Be proud of it. Don't feel inferior. Not to feel inferior, not to experience an inferiority complex. The thought should never occur that it is important to cooperate just a little bit with the modern trend or with the secular modern philosophy. This is Rav Soloveitchik talking 40 years ago. In my opinion, says Rav Soloveitchik, Yadus does not have to apologize either to the modern woman or to the modern representative of religious subjectivism. There is no need for apology. We don't need to be living in an apologetic state, in a reactive state. We should have pride in our Mesorah. How true that is today as it ever was before. We should have pride in our Mesorah, in our heritage. And of course, certainly it goes without saying, one must not try to compromise with these cultural trends. One must not try to gear the halachic norm to the transient values of a neurotic society, which is what our society is. How penetrating, how prophetic, how predictive, how far-sighted it was of him to say this 40 years ago. And I think when we discuss the issue of Mesorah and Minhagim in our communities, we remind ourselves of what he just said, to be proud of our Mesorah. Be proud of our energy, of our heritage. Never back down. Never feel that you should compromise either in principle or even in emotion. You have nothing to be apologetic about. We stand for thousands of years of Mesorah. That's what we will always stand for, and that's what will prevail. The truth will prevail, and we have nothing to be afraid of. This, says Rav Soloveitchik, is the perspective all of us should have as God-fearing, as observant Jews. So let's begin our conversation about Minhagim with the Chasam Sofer. There's a biography written called the Sefer Chut HaMeshulash. You look on the second side of the page. The Sefer Chut HaMeshulash is written by the grandson of the Chasam Sofer. And it's a biography about three great Torah giants. It's about the Chasam Sofer, about his father-in-law, Rabbi Kiva Eger, and about the Chasam Sofer's son, the Ksav Sofer. So this is written by a grandson. It's a very reliable Sefer. And for anyone who's into history, the Chasam Sofer lived at a time when he was fighting against the reform movement that was just beginning at the grassroots efforts in his generation. And he was fighting tooth and nail to make sure that they were not going to be successful. That was the battle of his time. So the Chasam Sofer, the grandson, writes here, was such a sweet, loving, wonderful, warm person. And he writes, all of a sudden, uncharacteristically, when it came to these issues of Reform Judaism, the Chasam Sofer went so out of himself. He acted so not like he normally would. And the grandson picked up on it. And he had a discussion with his grandfather why it is that he reacts in such a way. It's so inappropriate. It's so not like you. And listen what he says. So one of the, just for example, Chasam Sofer was so concerned about changing any of the practices of his generation because he felt anything that he changes will immediately lead to a greater change and a great schism in the Jewish community. So for example, in the time of the Chasam Sofer, again, it's not so relevant today because it doesn't really mean anything today in our contemporary shuls. I'm not disregarding the Chasam Sofer, but just in historical context, it meant much more in his generation than it does now. So the practice always was that the Chazan davened in the front of the shul, and he had a bima where they leaned from the Sefer Torah in the middle of the shul. In his generation, they decided the young people need to be closer to the Chazan, whatever it might be. They moved the Chazan to the middle. And the Chasam Sofer said something like, any shul that has the Chazan davening from the middle, which by the way is all of our shuls now, but any shul that has the Chazan davening in the middle is considered a reformed temple. You are not allowed to go there. You can't be part of their minyan. He went totally to the extreme. Sounds very extreme about something that is somewhat trivial. Why is it so important that the Chazan daven in the front of the shul instead of in the middle? But here the Chasam Sofer felt it was important to uphold the minhag of his time. So I discussed it with Rav Asher Weiss recently. We were talking about minhagim a couple of months ago, and I said to him, should we really think about the words of the Chasam Sofer? Look, nowadays we have the Chazan davens in the middle of the shul just for practical consideration. The people in the back can't hear, the people upstairs can't hear, so we put the person in a situation where it will be easier for them to be heard. So he said, look, the Chasam Sofer was fighting against the tidal wave of his time. This was just the beginning of an uprising against the traditional Orthodox synagogue that they used to have. Nowadays, it's not a symbol of anything. But in every generation, we have such issues, we have such problems, and we have to confront them. So here says the Chasam Sofer, as quoted by his grandson, why did my grandfather go so out of his character and fight tooth and nail against the reform? So not like him. So he writes as follows. V'tamo u'mamasho shehikbid kol kach al minhagi Yisrael. Why was it that my grandfather, the Chasam Sofer, was such a stickler for the minhagim? Even the minhagim that seem so trivial, that seem so simple, that seem so obvious, that seem not to be so important. Yan, that is, ki hem agidarim usiyagim legufei haTorah. Because the Chasam Sofer was of the opinion that tradition is the safeguard and the boundary for the laws of the Torah itself. And he says, Kemo shegodrim kol bayis lemano yavo haportze miyad el habayis penima. The same way we have locks on our doors and the same way we have video cameras to make sure nobody walks in to our homes that does not belong there. Kein hadover hazeh, he writes, so too it is with regard to our tradition. Umisharotze lahavir eza minhag. Somebody who chooses to obliterate, to get rid of any particular minhag, said the Chasam Sofer, to maso b'shulab. It is on him or her to bring the proof that this is pure, that this is correct. It is not on me, said the Chasam Sofer, to prove that my way is right. I represent thousands of years of Mesorah, of tradition. It is on the person who wants to change, Umei Ra El Ra'a Yetze. And I can tell you, says the Chasam Sofer, this will lead from one mistaken negative step to another, and it will lead in that direction. Gamel Mitzvahs HaTorah Atzma. Often it will lead to a neglect of the mitzvahs of the Torah that are absolute, that are not questionable. And the Chasam Sofer is quoted once again in that Sefer, and he says a very important line, Be'emes, I believe, says the Chasam Sofer, Minhagi Yisrael Torah Hema, The traditions of the Jewish people are just as much a fabric of the Torah as any line in Shulchan Aruch is, as any pasuk in Chumash is. It is Gufei HaTorah, Umiragla Bepumei Shalach Samsofer, the Chasam Sofer, my grandfather used to say, Kol mi she'en lo ela Torah. Anyone, like people in our generation who say, well, if you can't show me chapter and verse where it says it, it's not true. It doesn't exist. Kol mi she'en lo ela Torah. Anyone who has that perspective and feels that it's only worthwhile if it's chapter and verse, if you have the text, afilu Torah ein lo. You don't even have Torah itself. If a person doesn't live with the Mesorah, if a person does not appreciate the tradition, we cannot even speak about a meaningful experience of Torah observance at all. And that's why the Chasam Sofer chose to take this issue as his battle, as something he was going to make sure with all of his strength, with everything that he had, with all of his following, and fight it as much as he could, although it was very much against his nature. It's not what he wanted to do. It doesn't make anyone comfortable to do that. But that's what the Chasam Sofer was living through. You look in a tshuva in the Chasam Sofer where he writes, and again, you find it's a recurrent theme in the Chasam Sofer where he talks very often about minhagim, and he offers his opinion about changing minhagim. And here the Chasam Sofer writes in a tshuva, this is number beis, look at the second half of the line, V'ragel ani lomar, and I have often said, says the Chasam Sofer, kol mefakveg al nimusim u'minhagenu, anyone who is mefakveg, who casts aspersions on nimusim u'minhagenu, on the simple traditions, on the Mesorah, on the minhagim, that we have known for so many centuries, tzarech bedika achara, we need to scrutinize, we need to question, we need to examine and investigate that person to see what is behind all that they're saying. Why is it that they're questioning the Mesorah? Why is it that they're calling the Minhagim into all of our question? So this again was in the generation of the Chasam Sofer. Chasam Sofer was in the 1800s. Sorry, yeah. Okay. Right, so it was... Right, so there's... So that's the question. That's the question. You know, again, I think it's an important point that you raise, because in the generation of the Chasam Sofer, you'll say, for some reason, that was a symbol of Reform or Conservative Judaism. In our generation, we don't assume that way. So you have to understand what the historical context is and what such a statement might mean. Again, nowadays we do it for practical consideration, and it's no longer considered a statement in any way to move the chazan from the front of the shul to the middle of the shul. But there are other issues, and again, I'm not here to get political at all. We're talking in the abstract about Minhagim and Mesorah, and I think it's important that we just think about how central a role it should play. Yeah. Absolutely true. It's absolutely true. And that's why I don't feel it's my place to get involved in specifics that are going on today, because I'm not of that league. I think in 100 years, time will tell. 100 years, time will tell.
But the Chasam Sofer was of that league, and he fought something,
right?
And yet it's still common now.
Again, he fought a battle which nowadays is no longer a battle.
Right.
Because it's coming from a very different place. You can say that about a lot of things, correct? No, you're absolutely correct. And that's why I say it again and again. I'm not here to show disrespect to anyone, because it's not my place to get involved. I just think to remind ourselves, as people who do hold on to tradition, as people who do value the Mesorah, just to remind ourselves what exactly that means. Like someone said last night, Dam ala hashib. There are many people who question us and why the Mesorah is valuable. Now we will know what to say. Now we will have sources to explain to us why it is important to uphold the Mesorah, and what happens perhaps when a person might not. Yes?
Can I just point out the irony that the woman here, sitting here talking about these issues were 100 years ago, if we had done that, we would have been run out of town.
Don't run me out of town over this. Yes. At least if I'm run out of town, you'll all come. So, yes. Correct. Yeah. Look, I believe in Satmar, I think they don't even allow girls to have a chumash that has Rashi on the bottom. So, Again, they're living in their own community. We're talking about our community. Yes?
I guess in line with the previous comment, though, how do you differentiate? We understand the importance of the Masorah and what's going on, but how do you, I mean, the tendency then is to say, well, if it happened in 1700, that's frozen, and now we, there's nothing to do. We can't change anything because that's the Masorah. What's the Masorah and what is involved in adapting?
In a development. Uh-huh. I think that's an important question. And I think it goes back to what Rav Soloveitchik said, that you have to be someone who's attached to the Chachmei HaMasorah. That's what he said. There's a league called the Chachmei HaMasorah, people who identify with thousands of years of tradition. And that's something that's important. Anytime we want to deviate or perhaps adapt a particular custom to our generation, it has to be done based on the great leaders of that generation. Again, it happens every few centuries that we do change certain minhagim, and there are things, and again, next week I do want to point out certain cases where you do find in the Sifrei Acharonim that things did develop and did change, but now we're just talking about the importance of the Masorah itself. Okay, any other questions before we continue? Okay, so let's move on. There's an absolutely incredible story about Rabbi Akiva Eiger. Now, Rabbi Akiva Eiger, I think it's an important story to this topic because here you had a shaila that was posed to Rabbi Akiva Eiger. It was a halachic shaila, it was an important shaila, and he paskened the shaila based on minhag and mesorah, which is very unusual. Usually you paskin a shaila based on sources. When you have a shaila that's more hashkafic, so you'll say, okay, so that's more in the league of mesorah, maybe it's different. But here he had an absolute cut and dry halachic shaila that he answered based on a mesorah. So here was the story. Story goes that Rabbi Akiva Eiger was presented with the following question. There was a community that did not have a lot of resources, did not have a lot of money, and the Sefer Torah that they had in the shul was probably in disrepair and it needed to be fixed, but unfortunately they were not able to afford to have a sofer come and fix it. And it was a very small town, and they tried to collect funds and they didn't have the money that was needed to do so. One fine day, somebody's walking in the forest there and they find a new, beautiful Sefer Torah. So everybody was all excited. They bring it to the shul, and they start looking through it, and they see it has every word, and everything's accurate, everything's correct. So they said to themselves, maybe we should just take the Sefer Torah. They put up signs. They asked, did anyone lose the Sefer Torah? Did anyone leave it out there? And they asked for a couple of weeks to find out if it was, if it belonged to someone else, to a private individual. And finally, they decided maybe it's time for us to take the Sefer Torah to our shul. So they sent the shaila to Rabbi Akiva Eiger. What's the shaila? The shaila is that the Shulchan Aruch writes in Yerideim and Reish Pei Aleph, that's in Hilchos Sefer Torah, that if you have a Sefer Torah that is written by a non-Jew, or a Sefer Torah that's written by an apostate, it has to be burnt. You cannot use that. Even though every word is accurate, even though every word is the same, it's identical to the Sefer Torah we have in our shul now, but because it was written by someone who's not a God-fearing Jew, or someone who is antagonistic to God-fearing Jews, we assume such a Sefer Torah is supposed to be burnt. So they said to Rabbi Akiva Eiger, how are we supposed to know whether or not this Sefer Torah was written by a God-fearing sofer, or perhaps it was written by someone who's an apostate. Maybe it was written by a non-Jew. Maybe we're supposed to burn it. Now, in my opinion, that's what we call a shaila chamura. That's a very serious question. We're going to hang up signs one fine day, all please join us in the town square for the burning of a Sefer Torah. That's a very dangerous thing to announce. It's a dangerous thing to do unless you're absolutely certain that this is a Sefer Torah that was not written by a God-fearing Jew. Listen how Rabbi Akiva Eiger paskin the shaila. And it just shows you how important Mesorah is, how important Minhagim are. Said Rabbi Akiva Eiger, you know what the practice is when we write a Sefer Torah in our communities. So generally we have the end of the Sefer Torah, we leave out, and we have community members come along, and I don't know how exactly it works, but some people who know how to write, some people who don't know how to write so well, come along and write words or letters in the Sefer Torah. Said Rabbi Akiva Eiger, it is impossible that that end of the Sefer Torah is going to be absolutely symmetrical. Can't be. You're having 25, 30 people in the community, everyone's writing letters. It can't be the same as the rest of the Torah. It's going to be a little bit crooked. It's going to be a little bit irregular. It's not going to look the same as the rest. So turn to the end of the Sefer Torah and see. If you see that the last paragraphs are crooked, that means it must be a kosher Sefer Torah. And if you see that the last paragraphs are symmetrical with the rest of the Sefer Torah, it means that it's a forgery. Now that's a profound psak. That's based on just the Masorah. You won't find anywhere that it says everybody has to come and write a letter and make sure it's crooked. It doesn't say that anywhere. It's a nice practice that we have. It's a beautiful minhag. And yet Rabbi Akiva Eiger, based on the minhag, based on the practice that Jews have been following for thousands of years, Rabbi Akiva Eiger Paskin burned the Sefer Torah. Burned the Sefer Torah. Because it cannot be that if it was written by a God-fearing Jew, it cannot be that the end of the Sefer Torah will look like the rest of the Sefer Torah does. It's a powerful psak. It's a powerful psak, but it shows how important Mesorah is. The Ramah writes in Hilchos Yamim HaNoraim, Siman Tav Resh Yud Tes. The Ramah quotes the Maharil. Now, the Ramah lived in the 1500s in Poland, and much of the Ramah speaks about our minhagim in Ashkenaz, in Ashkenazi communities. The Sfardim generally follow the Mechaber, the Shulchan Aruch, and the Ashkenazim generally follow the Ramah. So here, the Ramah, just as an aside, most of the psukim in the Ramah emanate from the great tzaddik, the Maharil, who lived in the 1300s. The Maharil was Rabbi Yaakov Halevi ben Moshe Malon. He was what they call the Avi Minhage Ashkenaz. He was the father of Ashkenazic of German Jewry. He lived in Worms. And the Maharil is the basis of much of the psak that the Ramah follows in Shulchan Aruch Arachayim. So here, the Ramah quotes the Maharil. And here you only have half of the story, but then I quote, the Maharil gives you the whole story and you'll see how scary that story is when you see it in its entirety. Look at the Ramah, writes a pretty neutral statement here in number Gimel. Al yishana adam yiminach ha'ir, a person should be careful never to change the practices, the accepted traditions of a community. Afilu b'nigunim o b'piyutim sha'omrim sham. Even in the tunes that are used, even in the paragraphs that we insert on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. So some shall say this and some shall say that, and no one can say the whole machzer. It's too long, it's too much. We can't concentrate for that long, unfortunately. So every community has a decision of what they say and what they don't say. So here says the Ramah, warning us in the name of the Maharil, please don't change any of the tunes, don't change any of the slichos, leave everything the way it is. Sounds very simple. What's the real story? Look at the real story. That was just a brief summary of the real story. But look at the real story, and this is written in the Sefer Minhage Maharil, which is written by the students of the Maharil himself, who wrote over many of the customs, many of the practices that they learned from their Rebbe, the Maharil, who was the Avi Minhage Ashkenaz. So he writes as follows. Amar Mahari Segel. So the student writes about his Rebbe, about his teacher, the Mahari Segel. Who's the Mahari Segel? The Maharil? So he writes a student about the Maharil. He had two names that he went by. One was the Mahari Segel, one was Rabbi Yaakov Halevi ben Moshe Molon. So it's the same person. So here, listen to the story about the Maharil himself. Frightening story. Ein l'shanos minig ha-makom b'shum inyan. Don't ever change any traditions in any area of traditional Jewish life. Afilu b'nigunim she'ein murgalim sham. Even to change a tune that people are not used to and to decide that, oh, we got to update them, Eitan Katz, let's do new things. No. I love Eitan Katz. But he writes, don't start changing things. V'sipar lanu ma'isa ba'atzmo. Listen to this story. So all the Ramah took was the beginning of the story. Don't change the Nigunim, don't change the Biyutim, leave it as it is. What's the story? So the Maharil said a story about himself. Everyone with me? Last word on the first line in number Dalet. V'sipar lanu ma'isa ba'atzmo. He tells us the story about himself, the Maharil. I don't know much about this community, but he was asked to be the chazan, the shliach tzibur, on Yamim Noraim, in this community, Regensburg, which was not his own community. And he decided, well, I'm only a visitor in this community, I'm going to do it the way I know. I'm going to sing the tunes that I'm used to. And it bothered him very much. He thought they had the wrong nigun for the haftorah. I don't know what he means. And he said, he said, look, I'm the chazan. I can say whatever I want. So I am going to add in, there's a piyut, there's a slicha that you don't say in this community, but I think you're all wrong. I'm going to add it in. And it was a piyut called Ani Ani Hamedaber, Asher Yasad Rabbeinu Ephraim Lomer Letfilas Musaf. One of the early Rishonim, Rabbeinu Ephraim, said this is a wonderful thing to say. So the Maharil comes along. He's invited to be the chazan in Regensburg. And he decides, not only am I going to change the tunes, but I'm also going to add some extra piyutim and slichos that they generally are not accustomed to saying in this community. Fine. V'amar sheba'osopam, I'm sorry, v'saber, and he thought, she'mitzvah lomar sham, l'chavad Rabbeinu Ephraim ha'mechaber. How can we leave it out? After all, Rabbeinu Ephraim is such a great tzaddik, he's one of the G'dolei HaRishonim, how can we not say that which he instituted? V'amar ha'manhigim alav, the Gabbayim went over to him and said, excuse me, we have a machzor in our community that we follow. This is not in there. Who asked you to come along and change the practice of our community? We don't care that you're the Ma'aril. We have practices that we've been following for a long time in this place, in this shul. You don't have a right to come and change that. We don't say this generally, so what are you doing? He decided, I'm not listening to them, I'm the chazan. I think it's proper to say it because Rabbeinu Ephraim is the one who wrote it, so that's what he did. Liyamim, after a few days, Mesa Bas Harav B'Yom HaKippur. The Maharil's daughter passed away on Yom Kippur. V'Hatzadik HaRav HaNiskar, and the Maharil himself said, Alav Hadin, this is on me. Shelaksa Bito Al Mashashina Minhag HaMakom. I deserve it. It's a frightening story. But the Maharil said about himself that he deserved it for getting involved, for changing the minhagim. Now you can say, oh, please what?
That you could believe that.
I don't understand the comment. I don't think it's our place to say that about people. We would never do that. It's God's choice to decide what happens. But to say that the Maharil story is not an authentic story, I think is a far...
I don't deny
That's what the Maharil wrote. That's a story that he said about himself. And you'll ask, what did the daughter do wrong? Why did she deserve it? These are all very important questions. But this is the Maharil. If we believe in the Rama, all of the Rama is based off the Maharil. He is the father of our tradition. And he says a story about himself, why he took Minhagim very seriously. Let's keep reading a little bit. What you see is that to abolish, to break from a community practice, from a community minhag, is something we don't take lightly at all. And yes, these stories should shake us up. That's why they're written in the Sifrei Achronim, to remind people of how important, of how central minhagim and Masorah is. It doesn't mean we point fingers at other people and say, you should have this and you should have that. We don't do that. It's not the way we live. It's not the way we talk. It's not the rhetoric we're supposed to be having. However, it is important to remind ourselves what is written in the Svarim that came before us about how central and important minhagim are. Think about another example. Okay, just hold on to questions for a minute. One of the great poskim in the generation of the mid-1800s, early 1900s, was the Aruch HaShulchan. And before the Mishnah Berurah was printed, most people were following the Aruch HaShulchan. That was common practice. He was a great tzaddik, Rabbi Chiel Michalevin. So he writes about trying to defend the practice of B'nai Chutz Laretz. Now we have a very strange practice. We only do Nesias Kapayim, the Kohanim only Duchen, on Yom Tov. Ever wonder why it is when you visit Eretz Yisrael, they duchen every day? What's the difference? Why do they duchen every day and here we don't? The mitzvah is to duchen every day. I also want the bracha every day. So why don't we do it? So the Rama talks about it. The Rama says, well, he hems and he haws and he says, maybe it's because a Kohen has to be in the positive state of mind in order to effectively give over the bracha to the community. And therefore, he says, since we're all worrying about Daigas HaParnasa, we're all running off to work, so therefore, we don't have the right frame of mind to be able to give the brachas properly. And what about in Israel? Yeah. So Rabbi Avram Shapiro once told my father, nobody works there, so they're not worried about it. So that's not the answer. I don't know exactly what the answer is. I guess it's good to laugh in the middle of an intense year. So this is what the Rama writes. Again, it's hard to justify, it's hard to understand, but this is the practice in Chutz Laretz. We don't duchen during the week because we're all worried about Daigas HaParnasa. And on Yom Tov, when we're all relaxed, that's when we have an opportunity to do it properly. Why can't you have Shabbos? The Rama talks about why can you have an unemployed Kohen? Why can you have someone who's retired already? Or a young child who's not working yet? Why can you have them? I don't know, these are all very important questions. So the Aruch HaShulchan writes, look, let's be honest, this is a big stretch to explain this practice. Really, you're going to tell me it's because of that? And he says he finds no rationale, no defense, no justification for the practice at all. He doesn't understand, why do we not have Nesias Kapayim every day of the year in Chutz Laretz? And yes, the Rama gave us a rationale, but he feels it doesn't do it. It's not good enough. So listen what he writes. Look at the Aruch HaShulchan. This is number Hey. Rabbi Chiel Michal Epstein, the beginning of the 1900s, writes, V'hinei, Vaday ein shum tam nachon leminhagenu. There is no real justification. Levatal mitzvah sase debrechas kohanim kala shana kula. Uminhag goruahu. It's an awful practice. I don't have any way of rationalizing it. I don't really understand. Yes, I know the Rama writes the reason, but the Aruch HaShulchan says that cannot be the real reason. Can't be. Avol, ma nase, what can we do? Uki'ilu basko yatza, it's as if a heavenly voice came out and told us, shalo lahaniach lanu lisa kapayim b'chal hashana kula. It's as if a heavenly voice came down and actually told us, don't go ahead and have nesias kapayim and chutz laretz during the week. So he doesn't fill us in. When did that heavenly voice come down? But what is he talking about? What was the story that he's referring to? So he doesn't fill in the details. However, the Netziv, who was a contemporary of his, the Netziv was born in 1816, passed away in 1893, Reb Naftal Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. The Netziv seemed to have the same story, just here he elaborated. He didn't hide the story from us. So he says, well, let me tell you what happened. In the days of the great Vilna Gaon, the Vilna Gaon also was challenged with this. Why is it that we don't duchen in chutz laretz? How come we cheat everybody of having this opportunity of being blessed every day? Why don't we change the practice, says the Vilna Gaon, and do like they do in Eretz Yisrael? Look what happens. Let's look at number Vav. This is the Sefer of the Netziv and the Meshiv Dabar. Zachruni, I remember Shashamati, Kemeduma Mechutani Mehagon Maharitz Hagona Bezen Devalajan. He says, I heard from Rabbi Itzel of Alajan, who was a relative of the Netziv. Shepam achas hiskim Rabbeinu Hagra, one time the Vilna Gaon decided, lahanik nesias kapayim b'chol yom b'beis midrashu. The Vilna Gaon decides, enough is enough. We're living in Vilna, I'm the rabbi of the town, it's my opportunity to change things and to get rid of this awful practice of not duchening during the week. So he says, tomorrow we're going to get up and all the kohanim are going to duchen and we're going to do it the right way. V'ikvuhu min ha-shamayim. And they did not let him do so. Min ha-shamayim. What does that mean? That night, Nilkach lebeis ha-asurim, the Vilna Gaon was arrested and put into prison. Be'eis ha-machlokes ha-nara be-Vilna lo-alein. So he took that as a sign, maybe I made the wrong decision. But that's not enough. He has a student by the name of Reb Chaim Velazhiner, the Nefesh HaChaim. He was the preeminent student of the Vilna Gaon. He knew that his Rebbe, the Vilna Gaon, was very agitated about this minhag that we have of not duchening during the week. How come only in Eretz Yisrael? What's the story in Chutz Laretz? How come we're not careful about this? So Reb Chaim Velazhiner said, well, if they didn't let my Rebbe do it, I'm not going to stop. I'm going to try it. So now he becomes the rabbi, and he decides, I'm going to try to do again what my Rebbe tried to do, and then got arrested and wasn't able to do so. Achar kach, he says, Hagon Aver Harom Arena Reb Chaim. Reb Chaim Velazhiner, the student of the Vilna Gaon, came along. Hiskim. Biyom Aleph Shebiyom HaMachras Yitzav Elisa Kapayim. So he goes up and he hangs up Pashkevilim all over the place. We're going to change the practice in Malajan. Everyone is going to now have the opportunity to have Birchus Kohanim every day. And tomorrow morning I want everyone to show up in Shul. And the Kohanim are going to duchen like they do in Eretz Yisrael. Uva Oso Laila, and that evening, Nisrav Chatzi Ha'ir Ubeis HaKnesses Sheba'ir. So, half the city burnt down, which included the shul itself. Virov is bonenu, and they sat down and started to wonder, hey, why could such a thing have happened to us? How could it be that our shul burnt down? Why did half the community lose their homes last night? And Reb Chaim Velazhiner came to the conclusion, Sheyesh bazeh eze davar sod b'sisrei hashpas habracha hayored al yedei berchas kohanim. Yes, you're right. I submit myself. I don't know exactly why this is the practice. I don't know why it is that my Rebbe tried to do it and was stopped, and I once again tried, and look what happened. But I can tell you, seems not to be a good idea. No, we have a mitzvah to do it on Shalosh Regalim. The question is, you have to defend why we don't do it the rest of the year. You're supposed to do it all the time.
Right. So
the Rama explains why we do it on Shalosh Regalim, because we're all very in a good state of mind. So this is again a very important story. It's an important story because it shows how seriously the Chachmei HaMesorah took the Minhagim and the Mesorah, and how much of a critical role it played in their lives. Let's just close with one final story. See, it's getting late. A story is told about the Rama. So you look through the Rama, anyone who's an avid reader of the Rama will see that very often throughout the Rama he says, and this is what we do and this is the practice, and he's almost like on a crusade to remind people and to inform them of what the Masorah is, of what the Minhagim, what the traditions are. So listen to this story. It's a story that's quoted in a few Svarim. I asked my father last night because I found the story to be a little bit extreme. My father said he also has read it a number of times in different Svarim. So the story goes as follows. The Rama lived in Krakow. The Rama lived in Krakow, which was in Poland. And the Rama came to his shul in Krakow, and he sees there's a very unusual practice. A very unusual practice. And that was, it used to be when they had a mikveh, it wasn't like today where we have heating systems and everything just runs on its own and you just have one woman who's in charge of the mikveh. It didn't work that way. You had to heat up the mikveh every night when people had to use it. It wasn't so simple. So it was a very difficult task. So there was a couple who was in charge of the mikveh. The wife used to make sure to tend to all the women who needed the mikveh. And the husband used to make sure that the mikveh was heated up and everything was running smoothly and doing what it was supposed to do. So the practice was, said the Rama when he came to Krakow, a very strange minhag, and I don't really understand it, but this is the story. The Rama says he comes to Krakow, and the practice in his community was the following. When a woman had a baby, and then she was ready to be metahar herself, she was ready to go to the mikveh a few weeks later. So the practice was that the morning after she went to the mikveh, they used to keep a ledger of who was there. I guess the mikveh lady used to sign everybody in, whatever it was. So the practice was that the next morning, Mr. Mikveh Man, the husband, used to go over to the husband of this woman who had the baby and give him a big mishaberach, a big yashakach, a big mazel tov and shul the next morning. Very strange practice. So it makes people very uncomfortable, and it's a very strange thing to do. So the Rama also felt so, and he said, hey, this is really inappropriate. This is very strange. You know, he's going to go look in the ledger in the morning and see who was there, then he's going to go and say to the husband, mazel tov, give him a whole mishaberach and a yihiratzon. He thought it was very strange. The Rama makes an announcement one fine day in Krakow. Enough is enough. This minhag makes no sense. This minhag is very highly inappropriate. It's very intrusive. It's insensitive. He decides, no more of it. Okay. Just so happens to be, there's somebody in Krakow who was on a business trip and was not there when the Rama made the announcement that we're no longer having this practice. So 3 weeks later, the man comes back. His wife happened to have had a baby. She's ready to go to the mikveh. He shows up in shul the next morning. His wife went to the mikveh the night before. And he's waiting. And he's waiting. And he's looking at the gabbai and he goes over to him. He starts cursing him and yelling at him. And he says, I don't understand. You don't care about my children? You don't want to give me the bracha that all other children deserve? I always knew you hated me. And he starts yelling at him. And the Rama is watching this whole scene unfold. Now this is very embarrassing. On many levels. And the mikveh man turns to this gentleman and he says to him, let me explain you something. I have two reasons why I'm not responding. Number one, because when you were on business 3 weeks ago, the Rama abolished the practice. He told us this is not something we should be following anymore. He told us this is not something our community is going to do. So that's the first reason why I'm not saying anything to you about your wife having a baby. Second reason is because your wife didn't go to the mikveh last night. And it happens to be that the only reason when you had your other children she went to the mikveh was because she was afraid that somebody would find out, because she knew that the next morning I would say mazel tov to you. And it turns out that last night you were with your wife and you violated an iser kares. And the Rama watched this and almost fainted. And he said to himself, I don't understand it. The practice makes no sense to me. But look at the consequence of somebody who tries to change a minhag Yisrael. And it's because of that, writes Rabbi Akiva Yosef Schlesinger, he quotes the story and he says, it's because of that that the Rama almost went on a crusade, on a campaign, on a movement to inform and to popularize the minhag Yisrael. And that's why you'll find in almost every page in the Rama, he says, and this is the minhag, v'hachi nahaginan, and he has different ways of saying it, but Rabbi Akiva Yosef Schlesinger writes, it's as a result of his own personal mistake that he made of trying to play with the minhag. We don't play with the minhagim. It's something we take very seriously. It's something that is so much a staple of our lives. And you'll say, we're left with so many questions, so many minhagim we might not understand. And we have so much which we're trying to figure out. So how do we properly integrate our lives with the society that we live in? And it is very difficult, and it is very hard. We live in an egalitarian society. We live in a society that believes in equality, in a society that believes that everyone should be treated fairly and equally and have the same rights and privileges, and everyone should be able to do the same thing. And that's very difficult. How do we answer that according to our tradition that we uphold, that we believe is sacred? And I think I'll just close with one piece from Rev Soloveitchik in his book, Sacred and Profane. He wrote an article, Sacred and Profane. It's not on here. We'll continue with this next week if it's of interest to people to talk more about Minhagim. But listen to what Rev Soloveitchik says, and I hope it will give some people comfort. The error of modern representatives of religion is that they promise their congregants the solution to all the problems of life. And that is an expectation which religion does not fulfill. We don't always have answers. That's what it means to have faith. We don't always have answers, and sometimes the truth of the Torah might be difficult for us, and we don't know how to explain it, and it might be very hard to accept. But that's what it means to be an observant Eved Hashem. Religion, on the contrary, deepens the problems, but never intends to solve them. When a minister, a rabbi, or a priest attempts to solve the ancient question of Eov's suffering through a sermon or a lecture, he does not promote religious ends, but on the contrary, he does them a tremendous disservice. The beauty of religion, with its grandiose vistas, reveals itself to men not in solutions but in problems, not in harmony but in the constant conflict of diversified forces and trends. That's what we all live through. That's the challenge that we all have. It's not simple. It's not easy. Religion does not always offer the answer. Religion sometimes makes life more difficult, more challenging, more complicated to understand and to try to internalize, and to try to integrate all of the values that we stand for, all of the Minhagim, all of the Mesorah that we uphold from our Chachmei HaMesorah. It is very hard to integrate all of them. It is very difficult to justify some of the practices that we have. It is very hard for us in modern contemporary society to try to be God-fearing Jews and yet to be engaged in the world at the same time and figure out what the perfect balance is between the lives that we live and the values that the Torah expects us to live by. It is not simple. It is not easy. But that, says Rav Soloveitchik, is what religion is all about. Very often it can deepen a problem for us. It can deepen our questioning. But it's at that point that we say, we are Avdei Hashem. We have the privilege to be servants of God Himself and to follow all that He expects us to do. So, Amir Tashem, next week we will continue.